Hello and welcome back to Metaphorically Speaking with me, Delia Delore. This is the podcast where we dive deep into popular phrases and metaphors, tracing their origins and exploring the impact they've had on the world around us. Each week we speak with a special guest who tells us about how their own experiences and story connect to the metaphor of the week. This week's guest is author Ray Studevant. Ray, or Ben as he is affectionately known, Studevant, was a mixed-race child whose unique look led him to fight a racial identity crisis his entire life. Each time he entered a room, he had to decide whether it was better to be black or white. Spending some of his childhood in Washington, D.C. also makes him quite an interesting guest to explain how the metaphor "Big Brother is watching you" resonates with his life. This week, we will be looking at a famous phrase from George Orwell's novel 1984, banned at various times for being too left-wing and too right-wing. It critiqued and shaped much of the political discourse of the 20th century and has found a fresh, unsettling meaning in the new reality of hyper-surveillance and big data algorithms.
Be careful of what you say. Be careful in every way. Be careful of what you do. Big Brother is watching you. Be circumspect and discreet. Stay light on your mental feet. One slip and you know you're through. Big Brother is watching you. Conform with all directives. Remember obedience pays. And when you watch that TV screen, remember it works both ways.
Slightly different to our normal episodes, this week we will be looking not only at the predictions Orwell made for the future of the world through 1984, but also at the mirror predictions of another book of the era, Brave New World, by Aldous Huxley. Whereas Orwell's future was one of violent oppression, Huxley's was a future of pleasure and vice, in which every citizen genuinely believes in the world order they live in and is grateful for their lot in life, no matter how far down the food chain they are. Crucially, for all their differences, both novels predicted a future devoid of art, liberty, and democracy. Once we've explored these dystopian prophecies and spoken to our guest for this week, we will look at the state of the world we're living in, with surveillance at an historic high, democracies under threat, and objective truth obscured behind a torrent of misinformation, and ask which dystopian future seems to be coming true. Written in 1948 and published in 1949, Orwell's 1984 predicted an authoritarian world made possible through persuasive surveillance, brutal repression, and the rewriting of history. It is set on Airstrip 1, formerly known as the United Kingdom, which is part of a larger totalitarian state called Oceania. This multiple continent spanning superstate is controlled by a political organization known simply as the Party, with a mysterious, quite possibly fictitious, persona at the top called Big Brother. Every room has a telly screen, a TV with an inbuilt camera. It can never be turned off, so party propaganda is constantly pushed into individuals' ears, telling them obvious lies, such as rations increasing to amounts smaller than they were yesterday. Equally, individuals never know when someone is watching them through the telescreen, meaning they never feel safe to voice their true thoughts and feelings. The Thought Police are a secret police force dedicated to finding dissidents and arresting them before subversive thoughts are voiced or acted upon. Family members report each other for thought crimes as minor, as saying subversive things in their sleep, thereby destroying all social trust and making it impossible for individuals to find confidence. The final key means of control in this world is Newspeak, a government-designed new language that reduces language down to fewer and fewer words. The goal of the language is to remove subversive words from people's vocabularies so that they are incapable of verbalizing or even conceptualizing subversive thoughts.
Zhang Hongbing's mother lies meters from the spot where she was executed in the Cultural Revolution. The years of upheaval and destruction Mao unleashed claimed perhaps a million lives. Even so, Fang Zhongmo's case stands out. It was her zealous teenage son who denounced her as a counter-revolutionary. One night, the teenager thought his mother spoke of Mao disrespectfully. In the furious row that broke out, she called for the return of purged leaders and attacked Mao for creating a personality cult.
Brave New World was written by Aldous Huxley 17 years earlier in 1931 and was published in 1932. It depicts a future in some ways similar and in other ways polar opposite to 1984. Whilst goods are tightly rationed in 1984, with shortages of everything and dwindling reserves, Brave New World is a place of extreme hedonism where people seemingly want for nothing. Recreational drugs are freely available and their use encouraged. Entertainment, travel holidays and free love abound. There is no thought police, no fear and no coercion. Whilst to some this might seem like a paradise at first glance, a very similar system of control is at play. In both worlds, society is stratified with those at the top enjoying greater luxury than those at the bottom. Whilst in 1984 this is a simple class system, in Brave New World this is done through genetic engineering, conditioning and feeding messages to people in their sleep. The lowest classes, therefore, are literally smaller, weaker and less intelligent and conditioned to believe that they are happiest in their current place in society. Even the old sat waiting for death in hospital beds, accept their fates without fear or anxiety because of the messaging they're fed from childhood. Of the two worlds, most would probably choose to live in Brave New World than 1984. But whilst it is a more enjoyable existence, people are still fundamentally not free to have their own thoughts and feelings or to choose to break out of the system they're born into. There is nothing to force individuals to conform, but they are instead preventing from ever wanting for anything else.
Brave New World features a setting where everyone is conditioned from a young age to accept their role in society and to conform to its rules. And whenever this starts to feel oppressive, whenever someone begins to feel taboo emotions like sadness or depression, they're encouraged to take Soma, an opioid-like drug that helps suppress negative feelings and keep society orderly.
Some 30 years after the publication of Brave New World, and in response to the popular belief that a 1984-style future was imminent, Aldous Huxley wrote a follow-up essay called Brave New World Revisited. He observed that during the Red Scare of the 1940s and 1950s, there was a popular belief that heavy-handed, oppressive authoritarianism, as seen in Soviet Russia, was the great threat to the world, and that something akin to 1984 was imminently possible. He argued that this sort of boot-on-face, coercive oppression could only last so long before being overthrown. Whilst these methods may have been all the tools available to Soviet Russia, advancing technology promised new, subtler means of control. He predicted that as these technologies become a reality, a more seductive, voluntary form of oppression would be adopted.
Well, what is going to happen in the future is the dictators will find, as the old saying goes, that you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you want to preserve your power indefinitely, you have to get the consent of the ruled. And this they will do partly by drugs, partly by these new techniques of propaganda. They will do it by bypassing the sort of rational side of man and appealing to his subconscious and his deeper emotions, making him actually love his slavery. I mean, I think this is the danger, that actually people may be in some ways happy under the new regime, but they will be happy in a situation where they oughtn't to be happy.
It would be information and sensory overload, not book burning, that would make humanity disengage from politics. If individuals don't realize they're oppressed, they have no reason to resist. Only through manipulation of behavior and belief, making life feel good, would authoritarian power be able to sustainably suppress human freedom. So we've examined our predictions for the future. Now it's time for our guest for the week. The odds were stacked against Ray Studevant from day one. Born to a white, heroin-addicted mother and a black, violently alcoholic father, his childhood in Washington, D.C. was a chaotic mix of substance abuse, death, and neglect. Ray is a Pulitzer Prize-nominated author of Black Sheep, an unforgettable story of his struggles as a mixed-race boy, as he learns to fight the ghost of his past to find trust and love. His childhood in Washington gives him a front row seat to the metaphor, Big Brother is watching you. Ray, thank you once again for being a guest on Metaphorically Speaking. It's been quite a while, so I'm quite excited to hear what you've been doing. But of course, we need to start with the metaphor, Big Brother is watching you. How does that metaphor resonate with you?
Well, ever since I was young, it was interesting because growing up in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. was known as two cities. There was Washington and then it was D.C. And Washington was the White House, the Monument, the Capitol, and basically the white side of town. That was Washington. But D.C., and at that time, it was primarily blacks, probably 70% black when I was young. So at the top of the Washington Monument, we always thought that was the eye in the sky. And the White House was sort of like Master's plantation. It was felt like a plantation city. It was interesting. So growing up in D.C., you never, and when I was a child, you know, Richard Nixon resigned, you had to march on Washington in the 60s, and then Martin Luther King was murdered in Memphis. And there was, but there was also a lot of unrest regarding the Vietnam War. So it wasn't just the black community, but there was just seemed to be a lot of confusion and lack of trust for the government. So then, you know, culturally, you know, you started to sit back and you would hear a lot of the older people talk about they're watching you. Never talk to the school teachers who are asking you questions. Your middle two social, the two numbers of your social security number on this side of town is always even because they're keeping tabs on you. So these are things we heard. And then, of course, there were a lot of things that came to light later. Some things were conspiracy theories. You had a black power movement, but there was also the feeling that, and I think when the movie Roots came out, you know, you started to get a sense of like, wait a minute, because I remember when we started interacting, black kids and white kids were interacting at school, it felt like it was not what it was purported to be. Nobody really cared about race too much. But when Roots came out, and there was the whipping scene and all of it. It was almost like, wow. And then there were more movies about when The Color Purple came out. And it's like every, and The Color Purple came out in December of 1985. And following that, there seemed to be a pattern around the holidays of slave movies or white guilt movies to keep whites and blacks divided. And we thought, this is interesting. Who's behind this? Who's behind those airplanes known as chemtrails late at night? Why are these planes flying over? What's that about? And so the older people would always say, remind us, never trust Big Brother. He's watching you. Trust me, he knows. And we thought, man, that's crazy. Why would he be really worried? But it was what was known as the eye in the sky. And then you had all the, you know, with all the guns and the drugs coming in to the community. And it was the Tuskegee experiment where they were, never trust the vaccinations, right? Because I'm thinking, what are they really putting in these people, in our neighborhood? Is Big Brother infecting us? You know, why is there so much autism? You don't know these things. Like some people were leery about vaccinations. And so you thought, well, they're really trying to control, you know, these communities. And in the culture, you never trusted the government. And it trickled down to, if you had certain jobs, who's this boss we have? If you worked at a government job, as you got higher up, you know, you couldn't trust anyone because they were reporting back to Big Brother.
I need to ask you this, but before I ask you the question that's burning on my lips, I think we need to allow our listeners to know a little about you so that when you speak or when you answer my next question, it'll be more in context to your answer. So tell us a little about Ray, your childhood, your background, so that when I ask this question, which is going to be a cultural one, our listeners will be able to understand why you've answered the way that you have.
Okay. Yeah, that makes total sense. I'm glad you asked that, because I was an orphan and my mother and father, black father, white mother, got together in 1966 when interracial marriage was is still illegal. It just passed, I think, right after that in Washington, D.C. And in Virginia, I think right next door was when the first when the Supreme Court overturned the interracial marriage. But the point was, but I came out, I could pass for white. So when I started to interact on the other side of town, I could blend in and just really get the perspective of what many people were thinking. I had already heard it because my aunt, who was from Mississippi, ended up adopting me when I was an orphan. So now you can imagine she grew up in the 30s and 40s in Mississippi, segregated Jim Crow era. And she always reminded me that, because we were in DC now, to never, you can't just trust the government. It's all rigged. And then when you start to see that even white people didn't trust Big Brother, because I could just blend in and they never really knew that my birth certificate said black and that I'd come from that culture. And so I thought it was interesting that most people were generally the same as far as, not most people, but many people I met had a certain distrust of Big Brother. In different ways, though. You know, obviously, I think on the black side, it was more disguised. There was something such as the women's movement, the abortions. We had more abortions in, you know, the black community. It was like, keep the population down. Then there was the welfare movement. Okay, keep the black father out of the house. We will give you a check every month. You'll be a single mother. You'll work. The kids will go out here, get in gangs, go to jail. We'll keep the black population under control. Right. And then there was the feeling of, even if you were to able to be middle class, you were still striving to have material things, so we're going to keep you in credit card debt. These are the things you heard growing up. But in the white community, that was more of a lack of trust when it came to finances and how they watched your bank account, and they wanted to get you through taxes. And they more did trust from a financial perspective more than a population perspective, you know, if that makes any sense. It's more they were just didn't trust the IRS, didn't trust the CIA, didn't trust the FBI. And then when computers came along, and then the internet came along, social media came along, then the mistrust just grew exponentially. Because now they can monitor on your phone where you are, your iPad where you are, your spending habits. You know, and then they would watch what different culturally, what was important. You know, and black people, oh man, they like to be flashy. Okay, we'll just pump. You know, that's when a lot of, because most drug dealers were not really into drugs. They were just into being flashy and having money and getting women and having fancy cars to get out of the ghetto. That's a whole other conversation. But as time went on, cell phones, and all of these, the technological revolution seemed to be a game changer. But there was always a sense of, before anything is released, before anything is okayed by the government, there was always a feeling that, by many, how can we use this monitor people? And that was on not just a black culture, white, that was just across the board. They're watching you.
Well, Ray, your response answered the burning question that I wanted to ask, but it made me also think, if we had to substitute or compare the words Big Brother in the metaphor Big Brother is watching you with, say, your community that you grew up in, because you could pass as white or Caucasian, which is the politically correct way to say it in these days, if you were able to pass in that way, who was watching you? Was it your white community or your black community?
Oh, it was always the man, which was basically meant the white man, because he controls the world, is how we felt in that area. You felt that, I mean, if you look at the globe, you know, he has controlled the world for centuries. And so I think that, but in the black community, it was interesting because there was a religious aspect, that God is watching you. And sometimes the church, even though the church was big in the black community, religion was used as a means to control as well. Like, remember, the Lord is watching you. Because as long as you have that fear of God above the governments, actually the governments could use that to help people, because that went back for centuries, is using the fear of burning in hell as a means to control people in the name of religion. See, religion was based, a lot of it was based in fear. If you're not good, you're going to burn in hell. So a lot of black churches and church in general promoted, I mean, America was founded on Christian values, but control was implemented, you know, with this idea that God is going to burn you up, so you better act right. But I think it was more the black community. It was the man or the white man. And then in the white community, it was more known as the government, or as they call it today, the deep state. You know, and then you can get into all the conspiracies. You talk about the different families and the Rothschilds and things like that. Normally, the whites would name families who they thought were running. Some of them think it's the Jews, some think it's the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, all these, you know, elites is what they call them today. But when I was younger and growing up, you heard those names, but nobody was able to really piece it together and say those are the ones that are the puppet masters, so to speak, the ones who are really pulling the strings based on what they're observing. Because Big Brother's watching, but also there was feeling Big Brother's controlling. He's not just watching and observing, he's observing to determine what his next move would be. And that's kind of like how we were raised to believe. And then even in the white community, it was all like, to the point where most people believe 9/11, many believe that the CIA was behind that. A lot of people believe a lot of different conspiracy theories, but the fact that it's even believed by so many people helps you to believe that people do believe that there is a deep state or, a CIA, controlled government kind of thing. So those names usually come up when talking about who Big Brother really is, because you got to remember there's different aspects. There's the political aspect, there's the cultural aspect, there's even a scientific Big Brother, so to speak, and then there's religious that God is watching. And when you step back and, each individual has to decide, okay, who am I accountable to? I give the government my taxes. If they're an atheist, do they believe in God? Do they believe God is watching? Because a person that believes in God and tries to live by whatever their religious principles are, whether it's Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they believe that God is a higher source, and they're more concerned with what he thinks and the fact that he's really watching them above what any government may believe. Because when I lived in Europe, you get to know a lot of Muslims, and their accountability to Allah supersedes anything from any of these governments. Many of the ones I spoke with, obviously everybody's in a different path and at a different level of their relationship with their God, so to speak. But I had a lot of Jewish friends, a lot of Christian friends, and you can't paint the entire religion because there's so many different denominations of Islam and Christianity and Judaism even. But the idea that God is watching, and that's why you hear so many people say that even in slave times, a lot of people were able to deal with the oppression in many parts of the world, whether it was in slavery in America or whatever, based on the fact that God is who they answer to. It's almost like God is watching Big Brother as well.
That is such a strong point, Ray, and we could talk about this for ages. But I would also like to know what you're up to these days. You're an author. I know you've traveled a lot. I know you've got lots of things that perhaps you can't tell us, which is at the pipeline at the moment. But what would you say is the thing that you're working on the most or have worked on the most that has given you immense pride?
I always, when I was a ghostwriter and writing stories for other people's memoirs and their life stories, and I was fascinated by people's journeys, what they came from. So now Black Sheep, obviously we're familiar with that book. It was nominated for Pulitzer Prize, Forward's Book of the Year, Congressional.
Congratulations for that.
Yeah, so it was nominated for those. It didn't win, but it got so much acclaim. And so then I went back because the journey picks up that movie. So what I decided to do was the book, the story, not the movie. The story started later. And I decided to write a prequel, not a sequel, but a prequel, because I wanted to take the journey of that book and go back to the beginning of the central character and lead up to the beginning of the original book. So I'm doing that now, and that'll be released probably in about 2 months. But again, I think the journey of what people overcome is fascinating. How the human will, the desire, the drive to forge ahead It's incredible sometimes to think what people have had to endure, with the human spirit and the inner strength. You know, it's fascinating. And many of them do it as in a matter-of-fact way, in the sense that I know no other way but push through. And I learned that, and I became fascinated with that when watching other people's stories. I remember writing, I was a ghostwriter for one story where a woman, she was, grew up in the Caribbean. And so she, her mother, I think her brother was in prison. And so the mom had to sleep with a lawyer in order to get the lawyer to represent the family. So the mother gets pregnant, gives birth to her, right? And now she's basically orphaned off. And then she becomes an executive, you know, in New York City, from the streets of this small island in the Caribbean. And you think, this is just incredible, the will that this woman had. And so I've always been fascinated with that. And so that'll be what I'll probably continue to do. I'm not sure what. I'm going to probably venture into my first romance novel in January. Once I'm finished with this, I do promotion. I'm doing promotion meetings now for the next book with the library systems and you know, in America. But I'm going to venture into the world of romance novels and soften things up a bit and see.
Well, that'll be quite interesting. Ray, we wish you the best in all your endeavors, and thank you once again for being on Metaphorically Speaking.
Okay, Delia, thank you once again. You're the best. I really appreciate it, and I'm flattered and honored that you even thought to have me back on. So I'm looking forward to it, and maybe we can, I'm sure you'll come with something interesting again. You always do.
Well, that was fascinating. Now it's time to turn our attention not to 20th century predictions for the future, but to the future imminently upon us. Having followed the development of big data algorithms and marketing for a number of years, our writer for this week, Laurie Woplington, believes that our imminent future is something of a fusion between what both George Orwell and Aldous Huxley warned against. There is a new force in the world that threatens to control our thoughts and behavior, undermine democracy, and make free will itself impossible. Its name is surveillance capitalism.
My longtime friend started grasping his chest.
I was fighting to catch my breath.
I used the watch to study my pulse, and it was wildly erratic. Things escalated quickly from there.
I placed my Apple Watch on his wrist, and I couldn't believe my eyes. An atrial fibrillation notification popped up. Holy cow.
Holy moly.
I looked down at my Apple Watch, and my heart rate was 187 beats per minute.
If I hadn't had the Apple Watch, things could have been much worse.
My doctor said it was your watch that saved your life.
Thanks for helping save my friend's life.
Since the heart event was without other symptoms, clearly the watch was my only call to action.
You are probably aware of the fact that your phone, TV, maybe even your fridge, is monitoring your activity and selling that data to advertisers. You may not be aware of just how much data is being collected and how effectively it can be weaponized against you. Literally, every action online, be it a deleted line in an unsent email, mouse hovering over an ad, lingering eye on a social media post, is being recorded, saved, and rendered into data that advertisers can use to better target you with advertisements. Let's say you tend to exercise on Tuesday afternoons and usually reward yourself with a snack afterwards. The algorithm might push food adverts at you just as you leave the gym. It may even then figure out that when you run for the bus, you're marginally more receptive to food advertising and target you at that opportune moment.
You can either have people who look at signage that you want to adjust dynamically based on their feelings, age, gender, so you can target what you do. Or it can be just for statistics collection in a store. You want to know where people have put their attention and how they feel about it.
Other applications include recognizing VIP customers or checking in airline passengers.
I would feel much safer actually boarding a plane when my face is identified and I know that everybody else on the plane is matched at the last moment with that database.
The data collected is so vast and the algorithms are able to process so much data at once that your data can be compared against that of every other online individual on Earth in real time. This means they are able to identify trends that you may not even be aware of yourself. And whilst the advertising you're targeted with may sometimes seem crude and ineffective now, these algorithms are being fed new information every moment of every day and are being iteratively redesigned to be ever more effective. We've all witnessed the incredibly rapid rise of generative AI models such as ChatGPT, now powering everything from Bing's browser AI to Duolingo's new subscription service to countless customer service chatbots. Social media marketing algorithms are based on the same fundamental technology and have already started using generative AI to become even more capable. The harm these algorithms can inflict by exploiting our weaknesses, vulnerabilities, and addiction is obvious, but the danger extends far beyond simply selling us stuff we don't need. They can figure out what views you're most receptive to, what kinds of people you're most inclined to believe, and what motivates you to either vote or stay at home on election days. Just imagine what could be done with this technology if it fell into the hands of Vladimir Putin or the CCP in China.
In an effort to keep the Uyghurs under constant watch, China transformed the province into one of the most heavily surveilled parts of the world.
Every Uyghur over 12 years old is forced to surrender their biometric data, including voice, blood, DNA samples, and iris scans.
China is a prototype of what the 21st century digital authoritarianism is.
Indeed, we may not even need to look as far as authoritarian dictatorships to see the danger. In 2016, Cambridge Analytica, a political consulting firm, attempted to influence the US presidential election and UK Brexit referendum. They used data collected from social media platforms, surveys, public records, and commercial data brokers to create detailed profiles on millions of individuals. They then created psychological profiles based on this data and divided individuals into groups. With all this information, they were able to target swing voters and key demographics with political messages that spoke directly to their individual concerns. Combine this ability to predict and influence behavior with social media's power to trap an individual into an echo chamber by presenting them with only one side of every story, and a 1984 Brave New World hybrid future seems all too possible. Some nations may lean towards outright oppression, others to seductive distraction, but everywhere seems to be on a fast track to hyper-surveillance and control. If those who control the flow of information know exactly what information would persuade you, are you really in control of your own actions? How would you even figure out that you're being manipulated? Well, that's it for this week. Hopefully, it's left you feeling informed and fired up, and not like John the Savage at the end of Brave New World. If you're feeling overwhelmed by the scale of what we puny humans are up against, just remember that big data algorithms have the potential to cure disease, fight climate change, and end world hunger. Technology can be used for good and bad. The question is, who's using it? Thank you once again to our guest, Ray Studevant, for his fascinating contributions. I hope you've enjoyed listening to Metaphorically Speaking with me, Delia Delore, and we'll discuss the questions raised with your friends and family. Do share your thoughts on this week's episode on social media. Is the future 1984, Brave New World, or something altogether more hopeful? We really love hearing what you have to say. Don't forget, you can also suggest a metaphor for future shows by reaching out to us at colorful.com/shows/Delia. And consider sending this episode to your friends or leaving a review on colorful.com or on our podcast, Metaphorically Speaking, which you can find on Apple, Spotify, and all major streaming platforms. And you can email as well, info@metaphorically-speaking.uk. The more you engage, the more we can grow the show and keep doing what we love. Join us again for a new phrase next week. I'm Delia Delore. Until next week, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Metaphorically Speaking with Delia Delore, created by Delia Delore Productions, with original distribution by Colorful. This episode was hosted by Delia Delore and had segments written by Lori Wapplington. Production assistance and social media graphics by Odua Osawempke. The final program was edited by Kyle B. Mercier and social media videos by Ernie Denev. Podcast supervisor Jeremy Goldsworthy.